In politics, very strange thing happens from time to time, and today's friend sometimes turned out to be tomorrow's enemy, and yesterday's enemy turned out to be today's friend, and it is very acceptable phenomenon, and nobody question about it at all. In academic sense, however, we hope that opinion creates justice, and justice creates law, and law guarantees peace. Now this is what we are aiming at, and we always call peace, peace, peace. But
could we get you to move that microphone down a little? I'm not hearing it bad.
All right, thank you. But in actuality, in international relations, as you see, all the nations seem to outcry war, 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 rather than peace. And many theorists come up with the idea that by maintaining balance of powers among nations, we can guarantee peace. However, the ironic or the paradoxical theory, as it may seem, the reality of international politics is that we always, or any one country always, like to have overbalance rather than mere balance and maintaining equilibrium alone. We as an individual, when we have deposit in bank, we have a little bit secure feeling than whenever we write overdraft, and without money we spend check first. So this phenomenon is the inevitable situation of reality, perhaps ugly it may be, but the real sense of a term, it is the reality of the international politics. Same thing is true in the relationship of Red China against other countries of the world. And the friendship and dispute between Moscow and Peking is well-known evidence of this kind of international reality. Let me start with the basic foreign policy of Communist China. If I quote from the statement made in the 1st of October 1949, as you saw in the movie, in the film, it announced five major foreign policies or intentions of this country. First, Red China think the major aim of this country is to protect China's independence, freedom, and integrity. Secondly, work for lasting international peace and friendly cooperation between all countries. Thirdly, establish cordial relations with foreign governments whose attitudes were friendly. And fourthly, unite with the Soviet Union and other communist states and movements in the struggle against the imperialists, and in particular, the United States of America. Fifthly, protect the rights and interests of the overseas Chinese. The earlier Chinese foreign policy is characterized by her efforts to maintain all these five principles they stated at the time of independence of Red China. And this was accompanied by their effort to secure territorial security in the early development of this country. And it can be well attested to by the many incidents happened in the earlier time, beginning 1949, perhaps through 1955. If I enumerate only a few instances at this time, the intervention in Korean War by Communist China, an extension and some consolidation of Chinese Communist authority, especially in the neighboring nations, and extension and securing the Manchurian area, Xinjiang border with the Soviet Union, and the Indian border and the Burmese borderline, these disputes concerned with the borderline of this country also manifest the intention of securing firm territory in the early part of Communist China. And perhaps another important happening in this early era is the fact that the Chinese is giving more important leading image to the other countries. The first incident came with the problems of Indo-Chinese dispute, and China played a key role in determining the Indo-Chinese problem after the fall of Dien Bien Phu. Another important leadership by the Communist China is the so-called Bandung Conference, the Afro-Asian Conference, which was held in April 1955. And then up to this point, there is no break between Moscow and Peking at all. In fact, there are many rational scholars are aiming to pinpoint, which perhaps I can say in few statements, that both countries need their help. And mutually, they felt it is beneficial for them to cooperate rather than separate in their alliance. And Chinese needed it because they are just begun, they began their nationhood, and therefore outside mutual help, morally, physically, and scientific way, it is importantly necessary point. On the other hand, Khrushchev, after he survived through the power struggle between Malenkov and the Beria clique, it is essential for him to have a certain support from brotherly neighbor country of a big 7.5 million people in China. So there are mutual understanding why this cooperation is essential. And therefore, this cooperation was well done in the early period. But then, as I said, politics is a power-oriented mechanism. If there is national interest involved and the interest can be safeguarded by certain alliance, this alliance will last. But if certain alliance may damage the interest of a nation, such alliance may not last any longer. There is the rivalry beginning up between these two countries because of growing leadership role of China in world scene. Chinese foreign policy, however, in a brief statement I can say, it was geared to avoid the risk with any overall worldwide scale war, especially with the United States. Although Peking policy was always advocating the importance of revolution all over the world and the possible inevitability of contradiction between China and, or more largely, with this communist bloc and Western bloc. The main policy, before I ideologically examine the reasons a little more detail, let me give you some of the happenings first and then let's analyze together. Now, the seizure of Taiwan was the ultimate goal, but communist regime never pushed this goal to the point where that world war is inevitable. So they bombarded Kemo and Matsu, but that's just about the end of it, and they never pushed their policy through to have direct conflict with the Seventh Fleet of this country at all. And there is limited assistance extended to Burmese and Malayan, Laotian, and other southern eastern Asian countries. But only through indirect aggression, not the direct conflict at all. Because by all means, what the Chinese want to have is short of war rather than actual war, of which some of you may have a different opinion. Another important thing in communist foreign policy is the improvement of security by building up China's war potential. And for this purpose, the Mao hastily tried to have communism come in his own lifetime when he gets old, and then he pushed the idea of Great Leap Forward and People's Commune idea, and then again later this Cultural Revolution came on. Another important thing is the alliance with the Soviet Union as much as the China can. So they tried to have this alliance with Soviet Union insofar as they think they can do. However, as you know, there are some reasons why they cannot. Also, there is the areas of emphasis in communist China, giving support, as my preceding speaker well pointed out. There is a great massive effort of propaganda and the actual economic aid all over these developing nations. Causes for Soviet and China dispute mainly come from three reasons. The conflict of leadership of world communist movement might be the first one. The difference of opinion of the tactics or strategy of revolution, that means communistic revolution all over the world, that is the second difference. Thirdly, there is some conflict of interest which comes from the conflicting realm and interest of comradely assistance to the other communistic countries. Chinese feel that geographical proximity to the Asian country give better idea of leading Chinese leadership all over this developing nation, and the similarity of the situation with these developing nations and the Chinese economic situation may make this legitimate advocacy. And the Russian model, for instance, may not be suitable to these countries, while the Chinese model is. And the Chinese might contend that Chinese has the Oriental tradition, which might be shared by most of Asian countries, while the Russians may not have this tradition. Also, there is nationalistic interest involved, so there are many reasons why this can be done. As far as, in this limited hour, what I can pinpoint is only the Peking-Moscow relations, what happened and why. The first relationship was a very smooth one. In 1950, the Soviet Union and China made the Treaty of Friendship, Alliance, and Mutual Association and Assistance. And then there are different opinions by the different scholars. The most accepted scholar view is that 1958 is the turning point of these two countries. According to Peking's press, which I got the other day, the Peking's interpretation is that the It is with the 1956 Party Congress, the 20th Party Congress, the Soviet and the China became at odds. And there is another scholar who says it is even from 1954 this dispute happened. But as we all know, by the time Khrushchev was here in the United Nations and stated the Soviet Union will bury you up, until that there is no outside break between these two countries at all, and the public was unaware of that fact at all. And an official public charge between these countries begins in February 1963. So there is approximately 10 years of this dispute hidden and yet not known to many of the publics all over the world. And then as you see, the lake Minnetonka cannot be frozen in a day in three feet deep. So it takes time for this freezing process. In 1954, one of the evidence the scholars usually come up with is that Mao and Liu and Zhou did not attend the Peking celebration of the Soviet October Revolution. Usually it is the habit of these kind of big dignitaries to attend, but they didn't. And the Sino-Soviet Friendship Association lose official flavor somehow. And 1955, Soviet began to negotiate for a restoration of diplomatic relation with Japan, which won the China very much, because this is Asian area again. This is the another conflicting interest. 1955, Yugoslav and the USSR seem to have closer rapprochement, and this again won the Chinese very much. The condemnation of Stalin in the secret meeting or session of the 20th Party Congress also won the Chinese, because Chinese are more likely strictly in the line of Stalinistic idea, and it doesn't seem to be acceptable in many of these leading communist of Chinese. And there is some of the difference of assistance which was promised but not yet carried out by Soviet Union at all. But until 1959, Soviet Union tried to give more assistance, starting from mere 250 million ruble. It was doubled in 1956, and then in 1959, they promised that 500 million ruble and more is coming. In 1957 November, Russia tacitly gave the hint that Russia will help develop the atomic weapon in China. But 1959, 2 years later, this promise was withdrawn for some reason. As you can see, already by 1959, therefore, perhaps the turning point reached. Another important happening is that the coming up of Sputnik in 1958, which surprised this country as well as the another country. And this was the good turning point, because in Mao's interpretation, this is the beginning point when the east wind will prevail over the west wind. So they think that this is the now and the never chance, and we have to capitalize this opportunity. Of course, there is a different opinion of this fact between two countries also. Now, another important thing is the rejection of peaceful coexistence between the Western camp and the communist camp, which was very much criticized by communist China. Now, with these happenings in your mind, let me come to the analysis in a few minutes from the ideological background, why this break came and what are the major difference of opinions between these two countries. The downfall of Stalin and the rise of Khrushchev made Mao in a peculiar and unique position. As you know, Mao gave some image of Winston Churchill in versatility, and he think it is Mao who has more ideological philosophy rather than Khrushchev. And here again that the rivalry between two personality was formed. Maoism, or Mao, he thinks, in his term, is the orthodox soul Marxist and Marxism-Leninism as combined ideology. And he thinks this is the important thing. Khrushchev is the revisionist. That means Khrushchev is revising the orthodox soul theory of Mao and Leninism. First assailants made by Mao was that there is fundamental contradiction among many things. At least he said four contradictions exist in this world. However, Khrushchev do not seem to understand this Marxism-Leninistic concept of contradiction. So this is the first breaking point. The contradiction between the socialist camp and the imperialist camp, contradiction between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, contradiction between the oppressed and the oppressing nations, and the contradiction among monopoly capitalistic countries. In other words, the capitalistic countries themselves are in contradiction. And so fundamental goal of communism, Mao think, is proletarian revolution, not the economic competition at all. That is, economic competition may guarantee some peace for the time being, but ultimate goal is this revolution. That means the resort to violence rather than peaceful coexistence, as Khrushchev stated in 1956. And the world outlook of the proletarian party is internationalism, not the nationalism at all. By saying this, Mao's criticism up against Khrushchev was that the Khrushchev come up with a national interest-oriented movement. So what Khrushchev actually emphasized is that the Soviet, whenever Soviet situation fit, then he will come up with peaceful coexistence. But all the other countries may not be in a position to make this peaceful coexistence with Western country at all. It is selfish, therefore self-interest oriented policy. It is not the ideology which is acceptable by the world communist camp. And therefore, the Khrushchev thought Mao's idea is left adventurism, while the Mao criticized Khrushchev's idea is right opportunism. War, therefore, is in the continuation of politics and inevitable. He never said that war is just the objective of communist policy, but at least Mao contends that war is a part of politics, therefore war should not be the thing the Chinese must be worried about. Even before they come up with the nuclear blast, the Mao said three things. Nowadays, nuclear power must think twice before they use nuclear bomb. And the public opinion is such that nuclear threat to the world peace may not be so horrible as some people may think. And furthermore, what Mao said one time in his speech was that we never insist on war, but if we are pushed into war, we are not going to retreat. And what he boasted, he proudly pointed out the fact that there will be still 3 million people left in China while there is none in the United States. Khrushchev, in the meantime, direct the edge of their struggle not at the enemy of world peace, but at the socialist camp. according to Mao. So Mao's view is that the Khrushchev, instead of turning the gun toward the Western camp, turned the gun toward the communist camp instead. Now, if it comes to this point, and the peaceful coexistence seems to be the subordination to the Western countries, he thinks world communism must think twice before whether they will give the leadership to the Soviet Union. So let's come back to the one more crucial point, that is the interpretation of peaceful coexistence in the mind or in the terminology used by Mao Zedong. The Mao's concept of peaceful coexistence is this. Lenin said peaceful coexistence is essential, so did Stalin, and the Leninistic concept of peaceful coexistence is followed through Stalin to Mao, not to Khrushchev at all. Why? Lenin insisted constant vigilance against imperialism is needed, but Khrushchev came up with the answer that is, or that is tantamount to the concession to the imperialism. Another charge was that living in peace with the imperialist can be done only through struggle. But Mao thought, Khrushchev thought this is possible through economic competition as a way out from the social problems. So he think communistic concept of peaceful coexistence is nothing but the way out from the social problems which Khrushchev confront in Soviet Union. Another charge was that peaceful coexistence is merely a tactic, couldn't be the strategy or foreign policy at all. But unfortunately, in Mao's view, Khrushchev made peaceful coexistence as foreign policy or long-range strategy rather than day-to-day tactic. So it is blunder. And again, the Mao raised a question about the all-round cooperation. It is not only economic realm, the all-round cooperation is aimed by the peaceful coexistence, and therefore Mao think it is unacceptable and impossible thing. Another charge was that the oppressed and the oppressing countries cannot coexist at this period. And sooner or later it will break out. Temporarily there is standstill, but eventually these two camps cannot reconcile. But Khrushchev thought it is possibility, and the peaceful coexistence is the prerequisite of proletarian revolution, which is false conviction. So what Mao actually says then is peaceful coexistence caters to imperialism and is geared to pacifism, and more likely it is national self-interest oriented policy. So it defeats the purpose of internationalism, the world revolution by communists, and all the Leninistic true concept of Marxism-Leninism is betrayed rather than accepted. Now, therefore, Mao think it is the time that the paper tiger of the Western camp, although Khrushchev won, the paper tiger have teeth in it instead. What the Mao think is there is nothing to worry about yet. But as I pointed out, the Mao's foreign policy is very cautious. Nevertheless, Mao deliberately do not like to have direct confrontation at this time. And Mao's ideology came up with his own view. That is the peasant-oriented, guerrilla-oriented model, united front of classes, in which the even petty bourgeoisie can be accommodated. And unanimity rather than majority is the principle. And the what Mao said in his statement was that the Chinese position in the world communist camp is minority, but he think the communist movement must be based on unanimity. And a very interesting logic comes up in 1963, open letter to the CP, the Central Committee of Communist Party of the Soviet Union, saying that 90% in one time, and in another letter, 95% of the total population all over the world is now trying to engage in world revolution. And when this is the majority, communist view is what exactly this 90% to 95% population wants, not the Soviet Union's view at all. After all, it is revisionist in that broader made communism Americanized. And now Khrushchev tried to make communism Russified, and Tito, of course, did revised the communist concept of Marx and Lenin. So he think, in this sense, Mao alone is in a position to lead the real sense of communism, and the, therefore, he think, like the zero of Luther, when he stand against the Pope, the Leo the X, he think this is the very great task, and if communism can, the Chinese contention cannot be accepted by Soviet Union, there is nothing further can do. These two countries must break their relationship, because it is often, time and time again, the Mao's clique pointed out that it is the contention of China to cooperate with the Soviet Union as much as it, she can. But China cannot cooperate with the Soviet Union if it defeats the real concept of Marxism and Leninism. This is the main reason why they think they cannot cooperate. Now this will run down briefly in a short compass what might be the possible trouble spots in these two countries' relations. As to the other countries, let me say in 2 minutes what I can say, and then let me get more questions, and at that time let me explain in all the details. China is in a position of a very much isolated situation. China doesn't seem to have any friend to count on at this time. There is the, all over the world, if you classify the pro-communist, pro-Chinese, and pro-Soviet Union, perhaps as Professor Griffith analyzed one time, I will follow his line with a little bit of modification. Cuba, North Vietnam, Indonesia, North Korea became communist neutrals. Of course, it is also changing. Cuba's relationship with China was steadily deteriorating. North Vietnam, North Korea, one time thought as the pro-Chinese, is not any longer the pro-Chinese. They are strictly in neutral situation. And Indonesia, which should be the pro-Chinese movement, as always the Japanese communist movement in many ways, was toppled because of the fall of Sukarno, as you can see when this present situation. At this time, Chinese can count on Albanians, yes. And the Malayans, in a way Burmese, and some Communist Party members of New Zealand may be pro-Chinese. And the communist minority movement, yet the Communist Party of Thai might be counted. But the pro-Soviet movements include more numerous members, like Polish, Hungarian, Romanian, Italian, Belgian, British, Scandinavian, and Indian. All these Communist Party members are more likely supporting the Soviet cause. Especially extreme pro-Soviet factions can come from French Communist, the German Communist, Czechoslovakian, Bulgarian especially. And so under these circumstances, the Mao come up with the idea of a majority in terms of 90% of a total number. And whenever Soviet Union come up with you should belong to the majority view of world communism, he say, what we need is unanimity, not the majority at all. So this is the situation the communist actually has. Today's the Cultural Revolution will give you some of the idea what this communism actually means. But I simply hope that they have time to talk about this internal aspect of foreign policies. But if you raise a question, I would be glad to answer. And then why don't I turn this over to you with this brief statement.
Now, do you mean North Korea is mm-hmm. no longer pro-Chinese?
Mm-hmm. The question is whether North Korea is the pro-Chinese. And then I stated no, so the question is, why not? Let me point out two things. First thing is that many of the leaders in North Korea was trained in Moscow, not in China. And it is Russian troop which came to North Korea first, and not Chinese troop at all. And therefore, influence of the Soviet Union is magnanimous in North Korea. Because of geographical proximity and the friendship shown by volunteers sent to North Korea at the time of Korean War, North Korean is not in a position to say anything against Red China at all. That much is true. But the situation now forced them to stand still and sit on the fence and see which side is winning, rather than directly giving the side to any one country. That is the present situation.
When you were discussing Mao's objections to Khrushchev's peaceful coexistence, you spoke only of Mao. You didn't say the Chinese leaders. Now, would you feel that there is a difference of opinion on this subject in those who are now opposing Mao? Mm-hmm. And the second part of this question is related to this. Do you feel that this struggle in China now is primarily simply for power, or is there a real division of difference of ideas between mm-hmm. Mao and
China? Mm-hmm. The questions are whether the objection of peaceful coexistence by Mao can be shared by his colleagues in his top echelon of his leadership. Second question was
Is the struggle primarily a
uh-huh.
struggle for power or humans and ideas?
Uh-huh. The Cultural Revolution and the turmoil in the Red China today can be interpreted as the power struggle or possibly ideological differences. Now, the first question, yes, the reason I said only Mao rather than Mao's and the company is that the Mao's image was well built in Red China. Mao, as well as Ho in North Vietnam, and Sung Man Rhee one time in Korea, and Nehru in India, gave some charisma to the people. And this charisma means that it's something beyond the ordinary man. He has this particular person, Mao, is endowed with perhaps divine grace and wisdom and what not. So the people have the certain worship to him, and therefore he is in good position to lead until this Cultural Revolution break this image up. Ho seems to maintain that image yet, but the Mao used to, at least, maintain this image. And therefore, I can safely say that what Mao said is what the other person said. Because the Central Committee originally goes along with Mao most of the cases, at least the Central Committee is the rubber stamp in most of the cases. But the recently, there is the difference of views between Mao and the other leading group leaders in the Politburo. Especially, this come up with the concept of bourgeoisie cultural revolution, which you can find in the China today. It is very complicated problem to answer, but let me answer as much as I can in a brief manner. The pressure from the political party is always existing in the communist countries, and the people can withstand the pressure to a certain degree, but if there is a chance given to him, this pressure will erupt. In China, two times this chance was given. The first was the intellectual realm, the 100 Flowers campaign in 1957 by Mao. Mao hastily threw this idea away because Mao, at least in 1957, thought communism in China is so well maintained, there will be no dissident opinion against him. So he was so overly confident, and he gave this freedom to criticize if they want to, because the presupposition was that there won't be any, so nothing to worry about. But there are more things to worry about because of this campaign, and he started to restrain his freedom once again. And finally, this comes with the conflict between military, the youth movement, and the workers. The workers are in a position who have a family, who would like to have a better life. And all the pressure, the one of the policy the communism use is that one of the best policy to oppress the complaints is let them be busy. And there is no time to complain at all. Suppose you are asked to work from 4 o'clock in the morning to midnight. If you have any time, you better sleep rather than complain. That is the general policy. I do not see this as communist, the Red China's policy alone. But this is the some of the fundamental policies. So long as this kind of pressure, this kind of device is working, the people, whether they are dying by starvation or not, usually go along. But there is a time when this may erupt. And it seems to me, in my view, that in China it has come, especially proletarian revolution. Because of this, the extreme views maintained by Red Guard, this is more dangerously spread out all over these countries. Now, as you see, there are 22 million young men, the teenagers. They were born after the World War II, and they do not know anything but communism. And like the children, the education of children is very, very important in China as well as in Soviet Union. They have organization from the 5 years of age. When they got the 5 years of age, they have their group formed. And then at the age of 13 and 14, most crucial organization where they will give the certain labor force as well as the all kind of propaganda and agitation. And they are really diehard communists because they do not know anything else about communists. They are really loyal. They do not have any family to worry about. They have only the zeal and the philosophy and all kind of the energy and this gushing energy will be expressed usually in the demonstration on the street most of the time. And there is a clash between the living standard, which is constantly the concern of workers, the union members, and those who think that it is the color of bourgeoisie. And any leisure, any luxury is the part of bourgeois system, not the proletariat. So there is distinct difference between these two groups.